Hi, Kathy here. Starting a podcast like Family Flowers Only is essentially like starting a business, and like any business is full of what ifs. What if I cannot build the site? What if I cannot do the marketing? That doubt is totally normal. That is why Shopify exists, to turn those what ifs into a reality. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, helping turn big ideas into real life brands. If you're worried about design, Shopify's ready-to-go templates make it easy to build a beautiful online store. If you need a hand, their AI tools can help write product descriptions, enhance images, and even generate discounts. And if people haven't heard about your brand yet, Shopify makes it simple to run email and social campaigns to reach new customers. Plus, their award-winning 24/7 support is always there if you get stuck. So stop asking what if and start asking why not. Turn those dreams into... and give them the best shot at success with Shopify. Sign up for your €1 per month trial at shopify.ie. That's shopify.ie, and see what you can build with Shopify by your side.
Family Flowers Only, thanks to flowers.ie. Five-star luxury flowers, approved by you, delivered with care.
Before we get into the heart of today's episode, I'm delighted to welcome our new sponsor, flowers.ie. Now, given the name of this podcast, it's a partnership that just makes sense. If you're looking to send something special, these guys are the highest rated florist in Ireland with over 15,000 five-star Trustpilot reviews. They do proper luxury flowers and fast and efficient express delivery in County Dublin and surroundings, as well as next day delivery to all counties. But the absolute game changer is their video approval. They actually send you a video of your arrangement before it goes out, so you know it's just right. So head over to flowers.ie and use the promo code 5STAR for €5 off your order, because it's 5-star luxury flowers, approved by you, delivered with care. Hey everyone, back again this week. We are in the Go Loud Studios in Dublin, and I am joined with a fabulous Cork woman. I am with Lauren Golden. How are you, Lauren?
Hey, I'm good.
So good to see you.
Yeah, thank you.
And meet you in real life.
Yeah.
We just figured out that you know my sister-in-law. How funny.
I know. What a small world. It was the last name. I was like, there's no way there's more.
I know.
Of one family of Stretch.
Yeah. Oh,
that's such a small world.
I know. So obviously you're here with me today. I actually reached out to you.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times on my podcast, people will come to me because I kind of want to know that they want to talk about something like this. But then I do reach out to people sometimes that I see openly talking about it online. Absolutely. So that's why I said I'd love to sit down with you. You lost your brother, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
So what I always do is really important to me. I want to hear about the person. So can you tell me about Dan growing up? What was he like?
It's so funny, right? Because I was trying to get into the fields a little bit on the way up here, and I was like, how do I put Daniel into like words, do you know?
Yeah.
But basically, obviously the way Dan died, you'd be, I think people on the outside might expect a certain kind of character that dies by suicide, and it's so not true. Dan, to this day, is the most interesting and electric human being I've ever met, right? And he had a way of like just conjuring up joy, and in a way that everyone else would just feel it as well. Like, he would make an entire room laugh, and not because he was trying to hide anything in those moments, and I'll get a bit more into his personality later, but just because he just loved life. Like, when he loved life, he loved life.
Right.
Dan had a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, which we only discovered in the kind of the last years before he passed, but that's where the switch up is. It's like these electric moments and then times where it was a bit more difficult. And I'd say, like, looking back in our childhood, we were always so super close. I always just admired him. He was an out-of-the-box thinker. He, you know, I can look back and see where the emotional dysregulation was, for sure. But it was the way that he just celebrated even me and my uniqueness as his little sister, and encouraged me. I have so many amazing things to say about him, and I know we're going to speak about his death today, but I just had to honour that. Funniest, most electric, like, best crack, so funny, like really, really funny.
Was it just the two of you?
No, my sister as well.
Okay.
So the three of us, and I'm
so
the youngest.
Where do you fall and where does he fall?
I'm the baby.
You're the baby.
I'm the baby, and Dan is the oldest.
Dan is the oldest.
Yeah.
Wow. So
protective of you growing up?
Do you know, he didn't need to be for so long because I was in my own world and didn't really care about doing anything out of the way. But when I became a teenager, that was hard for Dan, do you know?
Really?
It was for my own reasons. I really went down the whole, like, male validation, breaking the rules, antisocial behaviour. That broke his heart a little bit. But when I was younger, I was just, like, frolicking through the fields, like, you know, loving on my animals. And there wasn't a need for that. But, yeah, I mean, Dan, like, you know, Dan liked control. Dan liked to know his environment very well. And I think having no control over us, because thankfully we had a very boundaried home and, like, you know, there were rules around how we treated each other. But I do think that he did enjoy having a bit of control because he loved us so much, but he could only have so much because he wasn't allowed, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was Dan into? Like, was he into sport growing up, or what was he, you know, in school days, say?
I'm laughing now because, again, like, see, this is a grief pod now, but when I'm speaking about Daniel, there's going to be some dark humour. Dan had really bad knees.
Oh, listen, this is not the serious pod. You bring all the humour in.
If you only knew, like, the eulogies that were going around mocking his bad knees. Dan did like soccer. And then he had, it's awful, Dan had really bad knees, and he ended up having knee surgery when he got a bit older.
Really?
He actually would murder me now if he knew I was talking about this. But other than that, his interest, right, his brain was fantastic. And I'd notice, and I can relate to it so much, I'd notice that he would jump into, like, different interests at a different time, but he would know everything about it. And it's funny because with BPD and with Dan, he struggled with self-esteem a lot. He was diagnosed with dyslexia. Later, near his kind of leaving cert years, he was finding it really hard, didn't know why. And also, he was like a late sprouter in terms of, like, he didn't grow height until, like, later on in life. So a lot of people who know him now, who knew him then, he was so handsome and very charismatic. So I don't think anyone would have known, unless you really knew Dan, how much his self-image shifted. You could see him and he'd have his hair dyed pink, blonde. He was totally himself, but his self-image would shift a lot, you know.
Okay, right. And is this in younger years now? He would have struggled with that.
I think, honestly, if I was to look back, I think always. With BPD, and I want to bring it back to, because I feel like there isn't enough awareness around it. We only figured out, again, like, later, just a couple of years before he'd passed, that he had that diagnosis of BPD. And it's really important to mention, because 10% of people with BPD will complete suicide, and up to, like, 7 to 10 will have at least one attempt, you know. So it's, we didn't know. And I was in the middle of my training for psychotherapy when Dan passed away. So if I'd only knew really how severe it was and how serious that diagnosis was, I think, you know, we would have moved a little bit differently. But again, that's the bargain inside of grief, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, I suppose, then, I know that you know now, as you said, you came to know in later life that he had BPD. But as he was growing up, or even before those years that you found out, what was it that you noticed, or what was it that, I don't want to say symptoms, but, like, I guess, what is it that you noticed that was
absolutely
struggling with, maybe?
Absolutely. So the self-image is a huge one, right? The one that shifts in and out. Like myself, I noticed he had bouts of, like, dissociation, where he'd feel a little bit disconnected. And that comes up when you're really dysregulated. His relationships were a big struggle for him as well. He had lots of girls who loved him. In his relationships, you'd see he'd have this very intense fear of abandonment. That's a big part of BPD.
Okay.
Intense fear of...
So friendships and, like, girls, everything.
For sure. When I think of Dan, the only person, and he, by the way, now had friends, partners who idolised him, and he idolised them right back. But the one person I think he could fully trust with all of him because of the BPD was my mum. Like,
I was going to say, your mum.
Oh, 100%. Like, that was his ride or die. She knew everything about him, the good, the bad, the in-between. The hard thing with BPD is that you have impulsive behaviours, you have outbursts and dysregulation, but you have he's, like I said, really intelligent. You have your wits about you. You have these impulses, these outbursts, and then all the guilt of someone who knows right afterwards, you know. So I think he struggled with immense shame in those later years, but also pockets throughout his life. It just, you know.
I think it's, why am I like this kind of thing?
Definitely.
As a sister, going back to those times again, before you ye I suppose, as a family, had that diagnosis. Did you notice, like, I know that you know now, obviously, with your training and everything, you have that vision.
Yeah.
But as his sister, years back, did you, I'm sure you wouldn't have had any awareness that there's anything different here.
I think I always knew that, like, the dysregulation was there, even though I couldn't really put a name to it. Like, you know, I was a kid now, and it's so funny how we got on so well, because we really did. We had a great relationship.
Was there many years between you, by the way?
5.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We had such a strong relationship for, like, a little girl who, when I was younger, like, you know, I was so sure of myself. I had a very strong sense of justice. And then you had him who, when we'd have disagreements, I'd have no problem speaking up. And he, I could just see he silently admired that, you know. So I knew he struggled with the dysregulation. But
so when you say dysregulation, what does that mean?
Yeah, when I was younger now, that, like, and we've discussed this, like, as a family.
Yeah.
When I was younger, the things I'd remember most, like I said, we weren't allowed to curse at each other. We weren't allowed to hit each other. Dan would go into his room and he would, like, scream, like, into a pillow. And just, you know, he'd get so, so frustrated. I remember that from a young age.
Wow.
Yeah. But, like, for the most part, like I said, these were his, like, pockets, and I don't think it was as severe when he was younger.
Yeah.
I think it got harder the more the demands of life crept up. So when he was younger, he was so nestled by my mom, so nurtured by her and minded. And I think it was when responsibility came later in life that it got a lot more difficult to manage. It was like, I think the big one, the first was the leave insert and, like, going into the workforce and having questions about himself and being dyslexic and questioning his competency. Now, he always excelled, by the way, everywhere he went. Everyone always loved him. He always did well no matter where he went. When he passed, and we'll get to it later, the amount of people that came to support him and who still message about him every single day, you know.
But very loved guy then.
Oh, so loved, so loved. He became a parent. He had adult relationships. And I think it was the pressures of all of that, little by little. It was just the demand grew, but his nervous system hadn't grown, you know.
When, I suppose, to someone outwardly, it's not very obvious that someone's struggling with that. Is it quite a personal thing? Is it just like you'd need to be living with them to see that they're struggling? So. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. I think, like, people who are close to him would know.
Yeah.
Because it would come up in relationship. It would come up in the trust piece. It would come up in the outbursts around people that he knew and loved. But there were a lot of shocked people who'd come to our door, do you know? A lot of shocked people would, like, just straight out asking, like, wait, what? He was so happy, you know?
Yeah.
But with BPD, it will, it's not something you can really hide, because it does impair, you know, your functioning a lot, you know?
Yeah.
So it would, you'd know. You'd know with the people that you're in relationship with, but outside, no, I don't think so. I don't think, on the outside, you could just see the fun, loving parts. You could see the party side.
Yeah.
Rather than the struggles.
So I suppose we're going to keep it back before he passed, if that's okay with you. Because I want to really get into, like, as I'm thinking of someone in a family that is dealing with this kind of a diagnosis. When he got diagnosed, do you remember, like, or maybe you were involved in those conversations, maybe you weren't. There was obviously a conversation about him going to get a diagnosis.
Mm.
Do you remember that time, or kind of what led to that?
So Dan was trying to seek help for at least, like, 2 years before he actually passed. And he did. He engaged with Pieda. He'd been to a psychiatrist. He'd been to his GP. And it was really in the mix of all that someone had plopped it down, but never really gave him, like, a formal chat about what that meant.
Right.
I had actually suggested it to him later on, kind of like a year and a half after he'd been to the psychiatrist. And when he went to the GP to ask about his files, it was there, you know. I'd kind of, like, and I think his partner at the time did as well, but it was something that had come up, and I was like, look, what do you think of this? He felt very validated by that, and he said it to me and my mum, like, thank you for, you know, even looking into that for me, because we continued to search. I don't know why it never came up about the rates of suicide with BPD. I don't know why, because I did do, like, you know, a bit of searching at the time around the diagnosis, and I know it meant an awful lot to him. But yeah, so that was the gist of the conversation. We're a very open family, really open about our emotions, really open about our feelings. You know, it's not this idea that, like, if you talk, that saves everything. It doesn't.
He went, you were saying, for 2 years before
yeah.
he went to try and get help. So what was it that pushed him to that? Was he feeling like maybe I'm depressed? Is that what it was?
It was these bouts of lowness that we'd, okay. that we'd know.
And no one could put a name on that.
Yeah, it was the struggle in relationships. It was yeah. just this question around like, am I a good person? Am I yeah. a bad person? And like I said, Dan had a nest in my mum. So whenever he'd struggle with a relationship breakdown or his mental health, his bedroom was flipped back into his childhood bedroom every time. Like he had a place, he had someone to speak to. Oh yeah, like...
yeah. Come in here and I mind you.
Oh,
yeah.
always, always. Like come in here and I look after you, you know. Mm. So, yeah, like... so,
like when you say he reached out to Pierre House, I'm thinking like he's feeling like I'm really low, yeah. but I don't know why.
Yeah.
So you kind of, everyone kind of just says, oh, you must be depressed. This yeah, is like what society
exactly.
says.
Yeah, exactly.
So he went and began to engage, as you say, with all those. So kind of what was he hearing back then from all of those services?
Yeah, I think that was a very like just personal journey for him, all of that and what was coming up about it.
Mm.
A memory came up recently of a status he'd put up that year. And again, like he'd have a really long spells of feeling great. So, he'd put up like, have hope guys, you know, I engaged and helped this year, it was so helpful, and it was the year later he'd passed away.
Wow, you know? Yeah.
So he thought he was on the other side of it, and then some life struggles came his way again and he was like, I just can't cope, you know.
Okay. Can you talk to me, I suppose, then about, so he had got his diagnosis, was he getting medication or anything like that?
Yeah, but unfortunately there isn't a proven like medication that helps specifically with BPD, like okay. you can manage the things around it, but it's more specific therapies that he actually wasn't getting. So like PIEDA, they have a program and it's amazing, but he could have really done with like DBT or something more specific for his diagnosis, you know.
Mm.
And again, knowledge is key, but we didn't have it then. So he was on medication and he was engaging with help as best he could. I think if it was a few years later and we had more information, things could potentially look different. I don't like to dwell there, but we didn't have all the tools on our side. And that's why I think it's so important that I mention this and that there are tools. And yeah, medication can help BPD in terms of it helps manage the symptoms,
yeah.
but the most effective is DBT therapy or some kind of specific form of psychotherapy for borderline personality disorder.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I suppose again, keeping there, it's great that we've so much knowledge. Well, it's not great actually. Hindsight is a great thing, as they say, but it's also devastating in your case.
Yeah.
The hindsight to know all of the tools and things that he could have maybe accessed and helped him. But I suppose if we go back to kind of as it's happening, he's engaging with all these services. He puts up a post even that like, you know, try and get the help. And
yeah.
You obviously as a family are concerned and watching and seeing how he's getting on. Did you at any point say, God, he seems to be doing better? Or was that a conversation?
Yeah, definitely. Do you know, there were times where we'd discuss him. And I mean, the times we knew he was really struggling was when he was back at my mum's. But also at this point, he's 27, nearly 28. He's living in and out of home. He is a parent. He has his own life and we have ours, you know. So we don't have every single kind of time that it got difficult. I think his partners would know more about that. But yeah, like definitely, especially in and around the time that he passed in that year build up, there was a good stretch of him seeming like he was doing really, really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, really well, actually. You know, he was engaging in like self-help books and he was still in therapy. He was in and out of therapy.
Wow, very
yeah,
good.
He was really trying, yeah. you know.
And so I suppose you personally, as his sister, maybe felt a sense of maybe peace that he's okay, he's getting his help. Is that how did you feel around him, or were you worried?
I was never worried about suicide with Dan.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
No. No, yeah.
I'll be honest. Like, yeah. there were times I was, but yeah. in that period, in that stretch, no, I wasn't. I thought
yeah.
he was the most open he'd ever been. He was exercising, which is really, really helpful for BPD as well. You know, he was trying his best to work things out with his family, his own family. Do you know, like, I think it was a really good period for him. And I think everyone said the same. They were like, no, he was doing so well. And
yeah.
But even at that, like the low parts that I saw of Dan, I still never thought suicide.
Yeah.
You know, that was his first attempt. And it was the attempt that was, you know.
Okay.
That.
Okay. So the 26th of February, 2021, I suppose for you maybe started off like every other day. Can
yeah.
you tell me where you were that day and kind of what happened, if you're able?
Interestingly, like that story for me starts at 4 a.m. Myself and my he's my husband now, but my partner at the time, we woke at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the two of us, I had a 12-hour shift coming at me at like 8 o'clock. So I was like, why are we awake? This is so annoying. Like, two of us couldn't get back to sleep, but we were just chatting away. It was COVID times, and I'd actually left my shoes that I needed on the ward in my mum's house, which is kind of on the way anyway, so I didn't mind too much. Got myself back to sleep, woke up then around 6 and had a message from my mum being like, Dan left me a word message. And I was kind of like, okay, look, I'll be down anyway. I have to get my shoes. I'll pop into ya. So I popped into my mum's and I just went in, and herself and my sister were chatting really worried in the kitchen. And my mum was like, I got this message from Dan last night and I'm just not really sure about it. It looks weird. And the message said, I'm sorry, ma'am. I'm no good. I never will be. Yeah. And it was obviously a frightening message. Alarm bells went off for all of us. But I had this sense that, don't worry, guys, it's going to be fine. Like, it's not what you think. Because I was messaging Dan on Messenger and it was saying it was being viewed. And it wasn't. You know, the guards had the phone on all the way this time. And it was coming up that he was seeing all of my messages.
Okay, which so you were less worried.
Us. Yeah, absolutely. I was giving him shit. I was like, you better answer this phone. My mum is so worried. What are you up to? I was ringing him, I was texting him, and next thing my sister got a phone call from a friend saying Patrick's Hill is closed, and anyone who knows Patrick's Hill, it's in Cork City, it's closed and there's guards down there. And at this point I'm really worried about the girls because they're panicked and I'm not panicked, and I'm just like, look girls, I'm going to drive up, I'm going to show you that there's no problems up there, and then I'm going to come back. I need to stop worrying about Dan because Dan's been partying all night and he's just having a roiler now and he doesn't want to face the consequences, right? So I drive up, I think nothing of it. I get to Patrick's Hill and there's nothing there. It's all back to normal. And I was like, see these idiots. Little did I know, as I left the house, that's when the guards called to give the girls the news. And I'm actually really grateful for that because I don't have that image etched in my mind. I don't have that piece. I got to get the news separately away from the house without that protector and me jumping in or whatever. I don't know what way I would have reacted if the guards knocked on the door, do you know? So I'm trying to ring my sister. She's not answering. I'm like, strange. I try again. I try once more. And she answers. And they're just screams. Like, there was just screams. Like, she said, you know, Dan's gone. Sorry. And she just says, Dan's gone. And I just said, I think I said, look, I'll be right home. And I hung up. And I think I'm still standing outside the car at this point. And I just take a couple of deep breaths. And I'm like, I need to get back to the girls, still in total shock. So I jump in the car and I'm driving, and at some point I ring my husband and I'm like, Dan passed away. And he's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I'm on the way to my mum's, and I hung up. So I'm driving back and I get by, anyone from Mayfield or like Ballyvlan area will know this now. I get by the old Callanan's garage and I'm stopped at a set of traffic lights. Watch me obeying the law now in the middle of all this. I'm just like there on like the middle of the morning, there's no cars around. I'm like, oh, it's a red light. I'm still not crying or anything. I'm just like, and the next thing that happened was really strange. So I stopped at the red light being a law-abiding citizen, and this sunlight comes in on me, and like no sun I'd ever experienced before, and it was warmth. And in that moment, it's really hard to describe, but I got this massive sense of comfort and peace. And I talked to him and I was kind of like, okay, Dan, if this is what you needed to do, just please help me mind my mum. Because I truly believed that my mum was going to be dead right after him, if I'm being honest. I thought she was right after him. And look, psychology says a lot of things about this, obviously. You know, they're like, oh, it turns on your stress hormones and you get clarity and you get peace. I've had dissociation. I've had my nervous system states from one to the other. I've felt it all, right? But all I can say is that the peace and comfort I felt that day, it didn't belong to me. And it was in like one of the hardest times of my life. And I felt like this was borrowed. This was a gift. And that's all I'll say. I'll let anyone put their own meaning on that. So I went up home and I felt like for weeks I was a different person. Like I had this strength that I didn't understand. I went into the girls and I hugged them and I just, you know, my mom, I just wanted to see her. The guards were still there. Even the guards were bawling, crying, you know. And I'm just, again, I just have this kind of calmness about me. And I'm like, it's going to be okay, guys. I almost wanted to respect him enough to respect his decision. And at this point, now I went through my own little pieces with anger and stuff, but at this time I'm just like, okay then, you know.
If this was the immediate aftermath.
This is
like within an hour.
This is within an hour, yeah. And again, I'm just, this feeling is just within me, do you know? And I had to do, I think in every family, we all fall into roles, don't we? Mm. Like, and at different times, like someone else might fall into one role at one point. But in that time, I was like caretaker. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just because for some reason I was able to function and that's what my grief looked like. It doesn't mean that anyone else's grief was wrong, like totally appropriate for everyone to, you know, act the way that they acted, feel the way that they felt. But I had to do hard things, do you know, in those few weeks that I'd struggle to do now, I think, do you know?
Yeah.
I had to call his partner, you know, the mother of his child, to let her know. I had to ring his cousin in Canada, who was like a sister to him, do you know? And you're waiting and you're hearing these reactions, you know, these screams. And again, like at that time, I was very present. Like, I know, and I'm so sorry. And you're going to have to come back to us, you know? So that's what the first kind of couple of hours looked like. My mom, bless her, was just in all sorts of shock. I don't think I was the one to call my dad. But he'd come and I'd kind of sat in the car with him to try and, like, before he came into the house and just try to settle him. My husband came, I gave him a big hug. I'm like, I hope you're okay. He was like, you hope I'm okay? What? And I'm just like, I know, but it's going to be okay. And I really felt that way the whole way through.
I'd imagine for a lot of people that you get that phone call.
Mm.
Well, first of all, you probably search through your mind, what happened? Did you know straight away? Were you told? And even if people are told, they don't believe it, or sometimes they don't believe it. But maybe for you, maybe knowing that he had been struggling a little bit, was it like an instant sort of, I won't say acceptance, but like, did you go through that phase of, what? No, this can't be real.
No.
You don't sound like you did, yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't. And it's funny because I only said to you earlier that I never would have thought suicide with Dan, but it was the mix of the message and then just the, you know, the kind of like, I'm no good, I never will be. And then just like, oh, do you know? No. And it's funny because I didn't even ask them at that point. We found out so many things later on by one of the guards, but like, and it was like, we're talking a few days later, really, but we all just kind of knew. And, the way that it works, I don't know if anyone's ever spoken about this before, but the guards return a bag to you, like with the clothes that they were wearing, with their belongings. I think they need a different policy there anyway, because it's really traumatic, you know. And again, I was able to hold the situation differently to how I think I'd hold it now. But I got like this bag and opened it and immediately knew my mum couldn't see it. So I brought it up to my childhood bedroom. And like, yeah, I mean, you just have their clothes covered in blood and all sorts, you know, and muck. And Dan was a clean freak, and it really annoyed me to see his jacket full of mud. And I noticed his shoelaces were missing, so that's how I found out how he died.
Wow.
Yeah, do you know, that was it. And I didn't know whether to tell anyone straight away, you know. I was just kind of like, okay. And it was like this way that my brain was, and this still, this hug, this comfort, I feel like I embodied him in so many ways in the early days, like into big brother role. And I know people might listen to this and think like, that's not healthy. It really was the healthiest process for me. I have the resources, and you know, like, obviously being in the world I'm in, we have to get constant therapy. I knew I was going to have space to hold all the other feelings that obviously did come later, but this was my true story of the first few weeks, you know. It was just it was almost a peace, and of course dipping in and out of the disbelief and the all of the other feelings, but for the most part, this kind of like, if you saw me in those 2 days, you'd notice me. I kept doing this.
Wow.
This nod into my body, you know, this kind of like, yeah. Okay. Because you see people when someone passes and it's a lot of shake in your head. I just kept being like, okay. You know? Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? Because you would see people trying to go around diagnosed, but she's in shock. She's in complete shock.
I know. I don't blame him.
You know, that's what a lot of people would say, isn't it? They'd be like, it hasn't hit her yet.
I know.
You know, this kind of language.
I know. And it's funny because we only put that aside for the really tough bits. Like, oh, she's in shock. It didn't hit her yet. What didn't? Grief is everything, do you know? You know, grief is sometimes the, oh, you know, I'm happy he doesn't suffer. I'm happy he didn't see this thing in this world. Or sometimes grief is the sadness. Sometimes it's the anger. But sometimes I hear people, they're like, oh, wait for it. And I'm like, wait for what? This is it. This is what it looks like. And it looks different for everyone. But we all go into different stages at different times. I'm going to grieve my brother forever. And it is going to look different sometimes, you know. But that was it for me. That was it. And you can call it shock. I don't mind what anyone needs to call it for it to make sense to them. But I know that I felt really minded, you know, and really kind of held.
Wow.
You know.
I've never heard anyone describe it that way. But I totally appreciate what you're saying. It's like, you know, it's total acceptance almost instantly. Not that you weren't heartbroken, angry, devastated, all things, but you also, it's like you instantly accepted it had happened.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and people have asked me about this. They've spoken to me about resilience and things like that, which I don't really like. Because I'm like, well, honestly,
I think it's a resilience.
It's not. No. It's not. And honestly, if there's any piece of it that is resilience, I mean, we grew up in Mayfield, like the second most disadvantaged area in Cork. And we all were hearing of mental health struggles, suicide from a very young age. I remember jotting it up with my friends when we were teenagers, and it was like in the double digits, you know, of friends. That, yeah, like we were exposed to this. I have people hear my story sometimes like on social media and things, and I'll get these comments about like, oh, well done you for this, that and the rest. And honestly, sometimes I just look back at my community. I look back at my mom, her life, my cousins, the things that they've endured, and I feel like all of them walked so I could run. Do you know? Our brain loves evidence. Our brain loves to look around and be like, can I survive this? And you've probably heard it on this podcast, like, can I do this? Can I really do this? How can I doubt it when I'm looking around and I see like my mum who's doing it, do you know?
Yeah.
My cousins who've been through so much, my community, all of us, you know, like people who'd come to pay respects for Dan, who'd also lost children and friends and family members to suicide, his friendship group. I remember one of his friends had come in. We just, you know, the way the houses go, like people just gather in.
Yeah.
And they were like, I'm sorry. And I was like, I'm so sorry. You have to lose another friend. Do you know?
Yeah.
And the suicide rates are higher in disadvantaged areas. So it's not like we never knew what it was. We knew that it was final. We knew, you know, all the terrible parts in between.
Yeah.
But the fact that we've not done it, because is grief ever complete, but that we've made it, that my mum made it, do you know? That was all I wanted at that time.
I understand, yeah. But I suppose, trying to put myself, I've lost a sibling, and I've never lost anyone in my immediate circle to suicide.
Yeah.
So trying to put myself into those shoes there of, you know, every relationship is so different. Everything is so complex. Everything is so unique.
Yeah.
You know, and so we've both lost siblings in two completely different ways. Yeah. So I can't relate to you. You can't relate to me, probably.
Absolutely.
So it's like, with suicide, I speak to people all the time who've lost someone to suicide.
Yeah.
And it's quite layered.
Very.
There's another layer there of trauma and shock, because it's not something you ever imagined was going to happen.
Yeah.
So again, just as not even like, I'd love to get into like your thoughts from your career, not your career, but like knowing what you know about statistics and all of that is so interesting, but like just as a sister, again, as the human,
I love that.
Yeah. How did you sit with that after the fact he was gone?
That's actually so good. And I thought about that when I was coming up here. I'm like, how do I separate me from like what I do, you know? Because I'm like, I want to give my story, but also this is who I am now. It's like my brain goes both ways.
I get you. Yeah.
I will say the way that it does overlap with the career, and then I'll get to me, is that like, just because you have knowledge and just because you have training, like it doesn't, you unfortunately you don't get a free pass with grief. Like it's still going to hit you.
Yeah.
It's just that you're like, well, we're mandated to see therapists all the time. And I think for me, it took the shame away. It took the shame away when I felt angry at him, because I had the information. I knew it was normal in my head, you know?
Okay.
But how did I sit with it as a sister?
Back then.
So we know that like the first kind of couple of weeks were that, again, that sense of peace with, of course, feelings in between and stuff. But going on from there, I think honouring him, connecting to him in the best ways that I could, his humour. Like, I feel like he just gifted us all with his humour, and it's so dark. Like, it's so, not everyone gets it. I was like, I need to tone things down when I come up here today. Because honestly, no. If you want to hear like the humour that we have,
you
well, he
hear
would
the
love
dark
it.
Humour we just had here for the last hour and a half.
See, I love horrendous. That. I love it. Yeah. But also, yeah, I know, maybe not for listeners, but like,
no.
I know, but it's genuinely
it's you.
Like,
it's your thing.
100%. Like, it's his as well.
I call this podcast Family Flowers Only because it made me laugh, because that's what they do in the death notices.
Oh, stop.
Do you have that where you come from?
We do. And you know what?
You know, they read them out on the radio.
Absolutely.
And they say Family Flowers Only.
They do.
It's dark humour, kind of.
Love it. My mom, you know, my mom banned lilies. Like, she was like,
oh, I don't blame her. Instantly, I'm like, funeral.
Yeah, she genuinely was like, and we listened, because with my mom, you listen to her, right? You know, like, you'd be a bit afraid. She was like, make sure no one brings a lily into my house. And we had, it looked like a rainforest of flowers, like, just bouquets and bouquets and bouquets and bouquets. Like, it covered the whole house. It gave her so much comfort. Not one lily, not one single lily. And that was her wish. And aww, it actually really helped. That's where community comes into it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, everyone that I was like connected to at the time, like, symbolized like my childhood, because I'd been moved out of Mayfield for a while, not too far, but like out of that area, you know. And going back there, I feel like whenever and you were probably the same when you lose a sibling, you lose anyone from your family of origin, it just shakes you a little bit. You're like, oh, what is everything?
The whole
you know?
Circle is
yeah,
now,
it is. Yeah, it's kind warped. Of it's not a circle. Yeah, that's what someone said early on. I forget which one of us it was. It was like, what is it, like broken? Is it changed? I'm like, it doesn't change what we had together all this time, you know?
Yeah. So I guess after Dan passed, then for you emotionally, what were you feeling? I suppose even about him, was there a sadness there for him? I know you had that spoke about that sense of kind of calm and peace. Was there anger?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Tell me about that.
I think anger was the first when I was coming out of like a lot of those early feelings.
Yeah.
I think anger was one of the first to resurface. And I remember saying this to my sister. I was like, I feel so angry at him. And she was like, I just feel sad for him, Laura. Do you know, I just feel so sad for him in those last moments. And I'm, of course, like, if I have to sit with that piece, and I have obviously in therapy and things, it's not usually where I always go. It's just not where my mind always goes is the last few moments, because I think I feel it when it comes up, do you know? Like, if I'm having a wave of sadness, you'll see me wait and catch the wave, do you know? Like, genuinely, I stop in my tracks and I see it come up and I watch it come back down. I just kind of allow it. But there was sadness, but definitely anger. Oh, loads of it. I was just like, what, are you for real? Like, how the hell are any of us supposed to do this forever, do you know? Like, why? Like, the questions. And it's so funny because I know why, do you know? But again, as a sister, you're kind of like, why, do you know? So I have, and I just still do. I still come in and out of all of them all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I have my own little chats where I'm either giving out or I'm like, poor thing, or I felt it all, do you know? I have felt it all. Yeah.
And then in terms of like regrets and guilt and all that kind of thing, all that come up for you as well?
I think one of the times when I felt the most regretful, it was like only a month before he passed away. And he messaged me asking, could he borrow? He actually lived up by me near the end with his partner. And he was like, can I bring your dog for a walk? And I was like, yeah, grab her in the morning. And he came the next morning and we were asleep or something. We just never answered the door. We heard him knocking and we were like, oh, we're going to sleep. And after the fact, me and my husband were looking at the message and we were like, oh, he was trying his best to cope. At that time, he was getting out to like walk and, you know, cope, to dip into his tools. And sometimes I do get a pang when I think of that. I'm like, oh, not because I thought that was going to change the trajectory of what happened, but like, that was something that he was trying to do to help his mental health. I'm sure he still went on his runs, but like, the fact that he wanted to bring my dog into it and that I, you know, didn't lean into it that day with him. Or like, me and my mom had called up to see him the week before he'd passed away into where he was living at the time. And when I left, he was giving me this big hug. And he gave bear hugs. Anyone who's had a hug off Dan will know his bear hug. And he was just giving me, I actually nearly walked past him. I was just about to go out the door. He's like, Laura. And he gave me this big hug, like this just really comforting hug. And sometimes I think about like, was that a like goodbye hug? But really anyone who spent like the 24 hours before he passed with him would say he was in very high spirits. That wasn't it. And with BPD, the impulsivity doesn't help, you know. They can make decisions that are really, really impulsive. Also, his when we had his inquest later on, his blood alcohol levels were really, really high, and we know that that can increase someone's risk of suicide. And then you have someone who already has a mental health condition, and then he had like his own that I won't get into, but his own kind of falling out that night. And I think that just brought up all of the things that he didn't like about himself, I think, do you know?
Yeah, yeah. So you, for you, I suppose you sense it was quite impulsive.
Definitely, mm. Yeah. That's not to say that never, ever would have been his path. But I don't think it was this kind of long-term premeditated thing at all. No, based on Dan, it was like very much like, things are going to be okay, things are good, screaming, happy, like, you know, so much fun. And then, you know, these moments of like, no, I'm not good, you know. Life isn't good, life is too hard, there's too much responsibility, I can't offer enough. Those are the kind of things that will come up for him.
I think you kind of probably touched on it there, but do you remember the last conversation you had with him?
It was there. And then I was coming to him about something as well. I was chatting to him about something that was going on for me at the time. It was so lovely. This was the time now he was really getting into all his own like psychoeducation. And he was very comforting for me. And yeah, I think the last words were that. It was just kind of like, oh, Laura, come back and give me a hug. Which, what a gift, you know. I know not everyone gets that. Not everyone gets a nice last interaction, which adds layers to everything that's going on. Mm. But yeah, I'm really happy with ours, to be fair, you know.
Yeah, that's nice. So the funeral for you, how did you find that whole process?
So this was COVID times and yeah, there was massive restrictions. But we actually ended up having his removal in our house. And we live in like a council estate now, right? We had everything makeshift at home. His friend is like big into media, comes on with like a microphone and a speaker. We all did little speeches. We played all his favourite songs. Oh. The estate was just full of people, full of them, do you know? We had some of us sing songs. Like, it was honestly so beautiful. And I think that adds to it again. Like, when people, I know you were kind of like, wow, I've never seen someone kind of handle it in that way. I really had a lot of things going for me in that. When you look at, when you break it down of what helps us, right, we had that community piece straight away. We had the support, we had like the integrating of Dan everywhere. He was everywhere, he was in every decision, do you know? And that was just so him. Like, we blared Dolly Parton, you know, Mac Miller. Yeah, he loved Dolly Parton.
Stop.
He loved Dolly Parton. Stop. I know. I'll get killed for this now, but like, I'm personally not the biggest fan of the song Jolene, right? He loved it though. So played all the time. Like, and just people just go for it.
We covered that a few years ago.
Yeah, and it's so funny because I was just, when I got here, we parked up in Stephen's Green. I went through and I was just passing. I looked, there was this big Dolly Parton like knitting. No. And I was like, oh, stop. Yeah.
Stop. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Loved Dolly Parton. He had a unique taste in everything, do you know?
I love that.
Oh, he was not.
And Mac Miller then?
Mac Miller, yeah, because they're just two completely different things. But that's him.
Yeah, that's him. Geez.
100%. Yeah. That's him though. You couldn't put him in a box. I even thought about that coming up today. I was like, how do I talk about him and put him into words? Because even like, if I could, I'd nearly describe him better with like a sound or like, you know, an action.
Yeah.
He was just wild. Like, he, for the short life he lived in, it was taken so quickly from him. Like, he lived, do you know? Like, he really just loved everyone. Yeah.
Character. How obvious is that hole then when he's gone?
I think I've been lucky in that. Like, again, I don't put shame in it or pressure on it when I feel that gap. That's him, right? But I've learned to kind of continue our bond, continue speaking about him. I think... social media helps me a lot as well, in terms of like, I would make like little bits of content about him on days where I want to speak about him, when I want to put it into something that isn't just words, you know. I think that really helps. We honour him in all the way. Like, on our wedding, we had speeches that were just very, let's just say, unique with some of his phrases in it. We had songs that we sang that were music that he loved. We drank the drinks he liked, you know. Like, we bring him into everything. I do anyway in my life, and I really try to. And sometimes that comes out in ways that feel so positive and powerful and like, wow, I'm so lucky I knew him. And then sometimes it's like, oh, I miss him so much, you know. Like, there were some songs I wouldn't play on the way up here. I was trying to get into my feels. I was like, what do I want to talk about today? There are some songs that I probably wouldn't play. I kind of know myself really well, and like, when I need to access certain parts, but we don't always have control over it, you know?
Yeah, I know. So then I suppose, you know, as I said, with suicide, it's so complex and it's so shocking. Most people don't see it coming.
Yeah.
Did it change anything for you, like, in terms of like, making you feel a bit scared about getting that phone call, or do you know what I mean? Like, there's a safety before suicide or a sudden death.
Yeah.
And then after the fact, it can be, tilts your axis a little bit.
Definitely.
Did you find that it changed you like that?
With suicide, there is that increased risk of like complex grief, obviously, and, you know, being, feeling a bit stuck in your stages and really struggling. Again, I have to, like, I'm really lucky with the support that I have and the tools that I had. And a lot of my family would have been like anti-therapy before then and are all engaged with therapy now. I think that was the first time when I realised, oh, these are the kind of things that can happen in the world, you know, to not just other people, but to me. Even though I saw it in my area and saw so many beautiful young boys and girls lose their lives to suicide, it was kind of for them, it wasn't mine, you know. So when it finally came
to your door, then
it was different, you know. And I see it all the time. Like, I work for an amazing charity in Cork called Shine a Light, suicide and mental health awareness, and they do a lot of work around the prevention side, you know. So we can see, and also the people who've been affected by suicide. So we see how complex it is. We see people really struggle to bring any kind of function into their lives for years and years after, you know. So I see it and I believe it. I think for me, I definitely had that kind of like, this can happen in life. But I've been really lucky. And I think if anyone is listening and they wonder if they can be there, like, we don't talk about mental health support just because we're like, this is all we can do, but it really does work, do you know? It really does. I know I would have, in a different world, right, if I wasn't in the mental health space and I didn't have to be so engaged and if it wasn't a priority for me, I think this would have been a very different story for me, do you know? I'm only so blessed that I know the effects and I know what to look out for, and I really hope anyone who loses someone to suicide can find those resources for themselves. Like Shine a Light now, if you're in Cork, offer counselling at whatever cost you can afford, you know, to kind of bridge that gap.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, but we'd all do one thing that is true for everyone is that we all need support. That might be therapy for some, but we all need support after something like that. It's not something I'd ever think anyone can battle all on their own, you know, with any loss.
Yeah, absolutely. What are your thoughts maybe on people that you hear stories all the time with absolutely no signs at all? I've obviously had people here who had no signs whatsoever, and no warning. And it's actually a terrifying concept.
It is, really.
Because when you talk to people, you're like, oh my God, you go home and think of your own child, or you think of your own husband, or you think of anyone in your life. You know, is there things that we can do? You know, what can we do with people? Obviously, we know when people are struggling, we really need to support them. We really need, really, really need to help them, encourage them to seek out help. But what should we do with people that there's no signs? You know?
The people who... So are we speaking about the people who've lost someone or the actual person?
Oh, no,
themselves?
The person themselves.
Okay, so I think that's where podcasts like this matter, where our voices matter, because you can't jump into anyone's head. And I see it all the time with my clients. They could sit down and be like, I smiled at everyone today, you know? Like, everyone thought I was the happiest person today, you know. So I see it, I suppose I'm aware of it. And they'll be like, you know, I saw this thing though, and it gave me a bit of hope, or I've been engaging in help and this is where I get the information. So we're not always going to be able to get the information by jumping into someone's head, but this is where it really matters to speak and to normalize. And we think we've come all the way. We haven't. Really haven't. We try. We definitely try. But you have to think, like, everyone that's only hearing about mental health now, really boldly in the last, 10 years, are adults. They've been through their formative years. Their brains have been developed to still have an element of shame around it, you know. It wasn't that long ago in Ireland you were institutionalised for your mental health. So the shame is still there. It's generational. So speaking out like this, having conversations, being so raw about it, and the vast kind of different experiences. Some people could have felt how I felt in those weeks with Dan, where I did have that sense of peace and feel massive shame over it. I wasn't sad enough. People probably think I'm weird, you know. That is my story, and I'm so proud of my grief, all of it, all the in between. I don't look any of it as like the good part or the bad part. That was my story, do you know. And
that's why I said it's interesting that you said that, because every time someone sits across from me, they tell me a different experience. You know, and that's what I mean. It's like, I get why you're like, you reacted in the way you reacted. It's like, because it was, that's your normal. That's how it happened for you. That's what happened. That's what came first for you, this calmness.
And also like that, when we speak about family roles, like, And I love all my family. I think they all handled it amazingly and did really hard things themselves. But there were some things that I really wouldn't have been able to do had I not accessed that, you know? Like there was a time where my dad had kind of called me and he was like, look, the clothes that they picked for him, like you can see the ligature marks on his neck. And I had to go up, I got my makeup kit, and I had to go down and try and cover it up because it wasn't, do you know? You're not able to do those kind of things unless you've accessed something. And isn't the human brain amazing? Isn't whatever essence we're made of amazing? Like whatever carried me through that, I am so glad of it, because we were all in our own stages and I'm not sure who else in that moment could have done that, you know?
Yeah.
But, and again, that's not the credit to me. It's the credit whatever way my system jumped up a gear, but that's what I was able to handle because of it, you know?
Yeah,
I think we're capable of incredible things, you know?
Yeah, I agree. But it's that lovely saying that grief is like a thumbprint. It's so unique.
It is.
And that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's so lovely to speak to someone and hear a different take and how they navigated it. Just goes to show that no one should ever feel like they're not doing it the right way or it's not normal, because it's like it's normal for you, you
definitely
know?
Or that it stays the same, I'm not like coasting through it that whatever that was whatever that was over those few weeks. I feel like I have two kids now, like he would have been the best uncle ever, do you know? That's all very hard in its own right. I just thankfully have the support, the tools, the knowledge to kind of help me when that comes up, and I feel it, and I will feel it, and I want to feel it for the rest of my life, because that's my bond with Dan, do you know? And I never want to lose it, whatever that looks like, you know?
How has your grief changed over the years since, even though it's not all that long ago, it's 2021, in my head I'm like, that's not that long ago.
Interesting actually you asked that, right? Because I spoke earlier about how important it is to find a connection, keep the bond up.
Yeah.
So I think like on the lead up to my wedding last year, it was like party, like, because he was wild. You've seen me on my hen, uncultivated. I hope everyone has deleted whatever footage they have of that weekend, right? But and even on my wedding day, I went rogue, like, and I loved it. I really, really did. And it was only, I'm actually the same age now Dan was when he died, and that was a big thing for me. I didn't want to be older than him. I was like, no, he's my big brother, do you know? And when I was approaching my birthday, I was like, all right, Laura, this is going to be a hard year. And it's been the hardest year, the fifth year. And it's funny because I actually heard a clip of you being like, it's like, you know, when your baby's getting older and you're like, oh no, look how big they've gotten. It's like that.
Isn't it?
It's kind of like, oh, what's that time? Because you know yourself, time doesn't, it changes when you grieve. But it was only when I was approaching his age this year that I was like, okay, I think, Lauren, you need to be a bit realistic about the link between alcohol and suicide, and his especially, because it was only in the inquest. I'm like out here now pregnant, by the way, in the inquest, reading out like all of his statements. But it was only in the inquest when they spoke about his alcohol levels that I was like, oh, we were waiting to hear drugs. We were like, not drugs. He was definitely on like some kind of drugs. No drugs, alcohol. And I was like, but it's just alcohol. And it was only after that I learned, like, oh my God, like up to 50% of deaths in Ireland involve alcohol, like, in the system. Do you know, like, it's by suicide. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So for this year, while we share an age, I vowed to have no alcohol. So I've been off alcohol this year just to honour him in that way. I had to look different for me this year and just to feel whatever I needed to feel, like, a healthy way. So it has changed.
Yeah. I get that whole honouring them the whole time as well. It's like you bring a bit of how they were into your own daily life. You feel close to them in a way nearly.
Yeah, like. And it's shown to help us integrate it, because that's what trauma is all about. Trauma is not about like, okay, I accept it in a way that like, I'm glad that happened. It's like, how do I make meaning? And we make meaning by somehow continuing a bond with them. This is how I do it with him. And it, like, the research shows that if you can bring them into whatever, and it's going to look different for everyone and depending on the relationship with the person, but bringing them in, honouring them, having new rituals, new ways you remember them. I mean, honestly, anytime I find myself really skitting laughing at like a joke that I probably wouldn't say in public, it's him, do you know? Like, I have so many ways where I feel my son is just the image of him. And reminds me of him in so many ways, you know. So there's loads of lovely ways where Dan is still all around me. Seeing a Dolly Parton thing before I come in here.
Yeah.
Speaking about him now with you, do you know? I'm just so grateful. Yeah. Everything that he's brought into my life because of conversations about him. He's everywhere, you know.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Where can people find you? You are working as a psychotherapist now.
Yeah.
What's the name of your practice, or do you just go by Lauren Golden online?
So I'm kind of back and forth because I'm expanding the practice at the moment. we have two kind of play therapists coming on board. I have a psychotherapist under me. I kind of trade myself with like Lauren Golden psychotherapy, but I'm probably going to shift that.
Okay.
But I, like, I'm not taking on any new clients at the moment.
You're just, not? Well, no. That's good.
Yeah.
You're busy?
Yes.
That's
very
great.
Very busy.
But yeah, Lauren does a lot of content online and, and a lot of it is extremely helpful.
Thank you.
Especially for parents, but also, as I said, she speaks about grief and loss there too as well. So go check her out there. But Lauren, thank you so much for coming in and being so open and honest today.
Not at all.
So many people.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
Right.
That's it for this week's episode. Thank you all so much for listening. Also, a huge thanks to our sponsors at flowers.ie for supporting the pod. Whether it's for a birthday, a thank you, or just because, flowers.ie really takes the stress out of it. You get that peace of mind with their video approval on every single order. And fast and efficient express delivery in County Dublin and surroundings, and next day delivery to all counties. With 15,000 five-star reviews, you know you're in good hands. So visit flowers.ie today and don't forget to use that promo code 5STAR to get €5 off. It's Ireland's highest rated florist for a reason. 5STAR luxury flowers, approved by you, delivered with care. Thanks again to them and to you. I'll talk to you all next week.